Decertified today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says he won't certify the Iran nuclear deal.
It's said that when his national security team told him this is a good deal, Mr. President, it's in the national security interest of the United States to keep it, he blew up. As one report says, he threw a fit.
Also today, we go back in time to learn about the roots of the word terrorism.
It won't surprise you that terrorism comes from the word terror, but comes from a very specific definition of the word terror, the reign of terror during the French Revolution.
Plus, acid attack victims take to the runway in a London fashion show.
The girls at the end, they went into the crowd and they pulled people out of the crowd, and everybody at the end was just dancing on the stage with these girls.
It's all ahead today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Friday. Another day, another move by President Trump to undo his predecessor's work. Yesterday, he signed an order to take apart the Affordable Care Act. Today, Trump refused to recertify the nuclear deal with Iran. Under that deal, Iran agreed to limit its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. But the president said the Iranians are not living up to their side of the bargain.
Today, I am announcing our strategy, along with several major steps we are taking to confront the Iranian regime's hostile actions and to ensure that Iran never, and I mean never, acquires a nuclear weapon.
Now, instead of sanctions relief, Trump is imposing new economic sanctions on Iran's Revolutionary Guard.
The Revolutionary Guard is the Iranian supreme leader's corrupt personal terror force and militia. It has hijacked large portions of Iran's economy and seized massive religious endowments to fund war and terror abroad.
Iran's president Hassan Rouhani has responded to Trump's announcement. He said it was full of baseless accusations against Iran. And among some of the others reacting there, young entrepreneurs and members of the country's budding tech sector. Bloomberg's tech editor Aki Ito spoke with some of them for the latest episode of her podcast Decrypted. So, Aki, first of all, give us a sense of how bustling Iran's tech scene is today.
You know, a couple of years ago, the tech community in Tehran was just really a handful of VCs and a couple of young entrepreneurs. But really, just over like the last 2 years, it's really flourished, changed the way people live in Tehran. Probably the best known service is a service called Digicala, which is kind of like the Amazon of Iran. And then there's also Snap, which is Iran's version of Uber. And these are services that people in Tehran today use every single day.
Right. And so when the Iran nuclear deal was signed, did that help the industry grow? Did it help it flourish? Did more venture capitalists come in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you have to remember for a decade, Iran was isolated from the rest of the world because of these sanctions. At the beginning of 2016, these sanctions were lifted, and that changed everything for a lot of young founders there. For our most recent episode on our podcast, we spoke to a really interesting woman called Fatih Amir Soleimani. She's the founder of an e-commerce startup called Kudaku.
We were finally going to access some real funding sources. And so we had a lot of meetings with foreign investors who were really excited with this country.
So, of course, that celebration was pretty short-lived. As soon as Donald Trump, who was a very vocal critic of the deal, got elected, you know, just the prospect, just the threat of that deal falling apart was enough to drive a lot of foreign investors away.
Yeah, so today's announcement of decertification, what do you think that's going to mean for entrepreneurs like Fatih?
So it certainly wasn't unexpected. Trump had been signaling for some time that he was going to decertify the deal. And this on its own doesn't mean that Congress is necessarily going to reimpose sanctions on Iran. But it definitely does add to the uncertainty that founders like Fatih are facing right now. So another founder we talked to was a guy called Ali Reza Sadeyan, who runs a bargain site, kind of like Groupon.
I think Trump's administration had some negative effects, and he's a very uncertain person. I mean, you cannot predict his behavior for the next week. So that, and the companies who want to come to Iran, they want to look at their next 10 years. So when they see that there is this uncertainty, they will have more doubts.
So a lot more doubt, and it strikes me that this isn't going to just affect the tech sector. The tech sector now has a lot of clients and customers that depend on them. So could this have a lot of ripple effects in Tehran?
I mean, it's certainly possible. There's no question that the lifting of sanctions allowed Iran's tech community to grow so much faster than it would have with the sanctions there. And that brought a lot of benefits to people who live in Iran, these benefits that we enjoy every single day here in the U.S. and probably take for granted. So we'll see what this means.
I mean, there's an irony here because Iran's tech sector was also able to flourish because of sanctions, because companies like Amazon and social media giants like Facebook and Twitter were blocked. So in a weird way, is there a silver lining to today's announcement that could, you know, just make the tech sector more DIY in Iran?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. Iran's isolation did help a lot of these homegrown startups have their Iran market to themselves without these bigger companies like Uber or Amazon encroaching into their territory. But for a lot of these startups, they're at this point where they do need access to foreign capital and also the expertise that foreign investors can bring to go that next mile, to expand into their next stage. And I think maybe even more than this access to foreign capital and foreign expertise, you have to worry about the brain drain. Someone like Fatih, who I introduced earlier, she's the Iranian entrepreneur behind Kudoku. She grew up in France, went to Columbia Business School. She was a banker in London for a few years, but she is now in Iran and building this company that is also helping other people in Iran learn more about the tech industry too. If people like her no longer want to be in Iran, if these people who are outside Iran right now, who are thinking about coming back to Iran, no longer want to come back to Iran and help build out the tech community there, that is going to have very bad implications for the future of Iran's economy.
Yeah. Well, bottom line, Trump's announcement today is not going to be well received by the young growing tech sector in Iran. Aki Ito, tech editor for Bloomberg and co-host of Decrypted, the podcast. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In Washington, House Speaker Paul Ryan said he supported the president's decision not to recertify the Iran deal. But the move has baffled and dismayed most American nuclear and national security experts. We spoke with one of them, Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation.
It's pretty clear the president of the United States hates the Iran deal, doesn't like it for a long list of reasons, many of which he's imagining, but he's determined to kill it. But he's going to do it in a very clever way. He's not going to take responsibility for it. It's very Jersey. He's going to open the door, but he wants the Senate to come in and do the actual hit. What he's doing is refusing to certify that Iran is compliant with the agreement, even though everyone agrees they are, and he's inviting the Senate to actually impose new sanctions on Iran that would kill this nuclear security accord.
And do we know how the Senate, how Congress is going to react to this?
This is clearly a coordinated effort. Senator Tom Cotton has stepped up to light the fuse to the dynamite that Donald Trump has now strapped to this deal. He's announced today that he's introducing a bill that would unilaterally reinterpret the agreement and impose new conditions on Iran. And if Iran doesn't meet those conditions, then the Senate would automatically put new sanctions on Iran. This violates the agreement and, if enacted, would kill the deal.
So the deal is not technically dead. Almost every nuclear and Iran expert we've spoken with says this is a bad idea, the decertification and this kind of eventual unplugging of the deal. What is the justification for this?
There is no justification for this. It appears to be the president's personal animosity towards the agreement, towards former President Obama, who negotiated the deal. It was a campaign pledge, and he is determined to fulfill that pledge. It's said that when his national security team, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the intelligence agencies told him this is a good deal, Mr. President, it's in the national security interest of the United States to keep it. Iran is keeping its part of the bargain. He blew up. As one report says, he threw a fit. And so this is basically a way for the national security team to appease the president's anger and help him keep a campaign pledge and hope that somehow in this process, they can actually preserve the deal. Our allies want us to keep the deal. National security experts want us to keep the deal. Israeli military and intelligence experts say, Mr. President, keep the deal.
Although Netanyahu is not a fan of the deal.
The only world leader who takes the president's position is Bibi Netanyahu, of Israel, but his military and intelligence advisors disagree with him. There's a similar split in Israel to what you see here. His former national security advisor, Uzi Arad, just gave an interview saying that, of course, we should keep the deal. There are flaws in it, but let's build on the deal. Don't blow it up.
In Trump's comments, he kind of took this long historic view of why Iran is America's mortal enemy, going back to the seizing of hostages in the embassy in Tehran in 79, and then brought us up to speed with Iran's attempts to finance extremism throughout the Mideast. I mean, there are respected figures in the administration like Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster who have long advocated confronting Iran and its proxy military adventures overseas. Why do you think that is not a reasonable goal?
Oh, it certainly is. But it's easier to confront Iran's aggressive actions in the region if they don't have nuclear weapons. And that's what the purpose of this deal was. Whatever issues we have with Iran, it's so much more difficult to counter those if Iran also has a nuclear bomb. So this deal, it was designed not to address all those issues. That was impossible. Not to address its ballistic missiles or its human rights abuses or its support for Hezbollah. It doesn't fix any of those. It's not a cure for cancer. It's not going to help you shed those unwanted pounds. It does one thing and one thing only, but it does it very well. And it stops Iran from getting a bomb.
And are you saying that getting out of the deal would actually accelerate Iran's kind of acquisition of a nuclear bomb?
There are several things that the president's actions do. Number one, it allows Iran to get out of the deal. If we violate the deal, they look like the victim. They look like the good guy. This is a win for them. If we break the deal, it breaks the limitations. It allows Iran to restart its nuclear program, and it breaks the inspections. All the inspectors are no longer there. We lose our eyes and ears, but it does something even worse. It breaks the alliance that we have with Europe, with Russia and China. Remember, this is not a U.S.-Iran deal. This is a deal with the nations of the world. This is a UN Security Council resolution, and we are breaking our word, which is why our European allies are so upset about this, why European ambassadors are besieging Congress to constrain the president to not do this. This fundamentally weakens U.S. national security around the world, weakens our alliances, opens up a gap that is already there between the U.S. and Europe. And it makes it much more difficult for us to negotiate any new agreements with anybody, particularly, for example, with North Korea. Mm. Why should North Korea make a deal with us now if every time the United States makes a deal, they then turn around and break it? It weakens U.S. credibility across the board.
Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
We've got a moment to take a quick look ahead to next week. We'll have the story of Clifton Truman Daniel, grandson of Harry S. Truman. Clifton's preparing to play his grandfather on the stage in North Carolina, and that means lots of practicing, even when he's mowing the lawn.
And it's an electric mower, so I know my neighbors can hear me spouting this while walking back. They probably think I've lost my mind.
All for the sake of making history come alive. That's next week, right here on The World. Just ahead, the surprising origins of the word terrorism. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Last week on the show, The New Yorker's Masha Gessen and I had a lively conversation about the word terrorism. Gessen argued in an essay for the magazine that we should not use the word terrorism. Here's some of what she told me.
Basically, terrorism experts agree that an act of terror has to pursue a political objective. And the person or persons attacked shouldn't be the direct opponents of the attacker. They're usually symbolic victims, and the violence is meant to send a message to the larger society. So the Las Vegas shooting doesn't seem to have pursued a political objective. And I also in the essay refer to Charlottesville, where right after Charlottesville, if you remember, there was that scene outside of Trump Tower when a reporter was yelling at Trump, basically demanding that Trump call it terrorism. And that act of violence, I don't think was terrorism because it was politically motivated, certainly, but it was a direct attack on the counter-protesters. It wasn't a symbolic victim.
It's a topic that we return to time, because here at The World, we think language and the words we use to describe what we see and what we know, we think it's important to get the words right. Peter Sokolowski is a lexicographer with the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. So you're looking at the Merriam-Webster definition of terrorism. Can you just read it to us and tell us if you think the Las Vegas shooter fits that definition?
Sure. We define terrorism as the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. And using the word terror in the definition of terrorism can be problematic for some people. And we define terror in this sense as violent or destructive acts, such as bombing, committed by groups in order to intimidate a population or government into granting their demands. And by that definition, we really have to say that what happened in Las Vegas was a crime and not terrorism.
Right. So in your definition, there is motive and it's a political motive.
Absolutely.
What is the history of the word terrorism?
Well, it won't surprise you that terrorism comes from the word terror, but comes from a very specific definition of the word terror. That's terror with a capital T. That is to say, the reign of terror during the French Revolution in 1793, 1794. And the earliest uses of that word, of the word terrorism in English, actually date to that period and reports on the French Revolution from people whose names we know, Thomas Jefferson and John Quincy Adams, who were in Europe at the time, reporting to the new American government and using this word terrorism in the very specific sense, meaning violence perpetrated by a government against people, not against a government. So the word had to make a shift into this other meaning, that is to say, organized protest or violence against governing, because the original meaning of the word was violence perpetrated by a government.
Yeah, right. I mean, the French Revolution was Robespierre and Danton chopping off everybody's heads on behalf of the state.
Exactly.
When did it make the shift then?
It made the shift relatively quickly. So we're talking about the earliest English uses in 1795 by Jefferson and John Quincy Adams and others. And then in 1799, we see John Adams using the term terrorism in the context of American politics. And he writes, "The coercion of terrorism cannot be practiced in America so easily as in Europe." And then he goes on to the issues of geography and politics that make America different. And then we see Jefferson himself in 1801 saying that he himself believes in the Republican basis of government, that is to say the new American government, to defy the machinations of terrorism and Illuminatism. And so he is using terrorism there as the idea of something moving against an organized government rather than perpetrated by an organized government. So it switched very, very quickly.
I'm curious, was terrorism ever used in a self-critical way here in this country in referring to slavery?
Not that I know of. I mean, the fact is it was referred to by, again, John Adams, these founders later in their lives, referring to revolts within America, like Shays Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania. And and it's worth noting that George Washington, you know, got on a horse and led the U.S. Army against American citizens during the Whiskey Rebellion. So that was something that was considered, you know, a very serious violent act.
So now the term has become so politically loaded and racialized that the word terrorist has almost nothing to do with the act itself and everything to do with the identity of the actor or actors, especially their religion. So you've got white Christians are almost never called terrorists, but Muslims are.
Yeah, and this idea of using terrorism in a non-political way, we saw in the 1920s when Al Capone was working in Chicago as a gangster. And what's interesting is to see the news clippings of the 1920s referring to Al Capone as a terrorist. And that clearly was understood by people as meaning someone who was a criminal, but not necessarily one with a political motive.
Also, brown kids are being called terrorists on the playground. It's a slur. I mean, do you feel confident that a dictionary can capture the nuance of this word today?
It's always difficult. I can say this, that at the moment, the definition of terrorism in all English dictionaries seem to include this idea of politics, the idea of making it specific to a religion or a race or something that is non-political has not yet entered the dictionary. That doesn't mean it's not used that way, however. So we do see evidence of this word used exactly as you describe, but so far the preponderance of evidence continues to be political in the context of news items that we hear.
Peter, what have you seen since the Vegas shooting? Like, how have people been using the word terrorist on social media? Is a definition on social media evolving beyond kind of this narrow sense of a violent political perpetrator to someone who's just violent?
Sure. There's a connection with the word terrorize, too, you know, that is so clearly related. And obviously, terrorizing a populace is something that is not necessarily political. That's a term that can be used in this broader sense. And I did see a lot of evidence on social media asking for our political leaders to use the word terrorist to describe this shooter. And the fact is, I think that is an effort to, in a sense, elevate the crime, to impute maybe motivation that we can't really know.
Well, using words to describe things that we don't know for fact, that obviously leads to fake news. And the BBC gives us guidance on how to use the word terrorist. We're supposed to be very careful when using it. That dates back from the troubles in Northern Ireland. Excerpts from the guidelines suggest we try to avoid the use of the term terrorist without attribution. We should use words which specifically describe the perpetrator, such as bomber, attacker, gunman. They say the word terrorist can be a barrier rather than an aid to understanding what's going on. What's interesting, though, is that dictionaries offer definitions, but the United Nations has again just failed to reach agreement on what terrorism is. And the obvious reason there is that terrorism is regarded through a political prism. So what do you say to that?
Sure. I mean, it's like this term freedom fighter, too, you know, that it always depends upon your political position. And it also proves the power of language, doesn't it? It proves that words matter and that the kind of language that leaders use and the kind of language that journalists use is very important. And I think that's something that we all have to keep in mind.
Peter Sokolowski, a lexicographer with the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Thank you.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming up in about 1 minute here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Weinstein scandal has gotten women all over the globe to talk about their own sexual assault experiences and about what stops them from coming forward.
I wish I was a Wonder Woman about this. You know, we're all about empowerment today and how girls should be heroes. But in this particular situation, I am not ready to be the hero.
That's still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH here in Boston. All week, we've been watching the Harvey Weinstein scandal unfold. It's a nuclear meltdown of scandals. The radioactive fuel doesn't stop burning. The number of women accusing Weinstein keeps growing, and so does the number of other women speaking out about sexual harassment and assault in many industries. Actress Emma Thompson, for example.
This man is at the top of a very particular iceberg, a system of harassment and belittling and bullying and interference and what my mother would have referred to in the olden days as pestering. Is he pestering you? That's the word we used to use in the olden days, if you recall. This has been part of our world, women's world, since time immemorial.
If I'm not smiling, I could not do this interview and I would just be like sobbing all over the place. And we don't need that either. So
that's Natalia Antonova. She's a Ukrainian-American writer, journalist and playwright, adding her voice to that of Emma Thompson's and many others. Today, Natalia published an article on Vox. The top line reads, "Some victims stayed friends with Harvey Weinstein. I did the same with my rapist. Here's why." I asked Antonova what she hoped to do by sharing her story, and just a heads up, this may be hard to listen to.
I realized that people were going to accuse his accusers of being frauds because a lot of these women have had to keep up a relationship with him over the years. And we have a stereotype about the way real rape victims are supposed to act. And basically, the stereotype says that when this happens to you, you recognize the man as the monster and you cut off all ties and you torch him in the public square. But that's not how a lot of people respond to this crime. And it's definitely not how I responded when it happened to me, which is why I wanted to write this piece, just to explain to people why somebody might be in that position.
And writing in Vox, you explain how much of what you've been reading about the Weinstein case, how it echoed for you, especially Ronan Farrow's account in The New Yorker, his revelations about actress Asia Argento allegedly being raped by Harvey Weinstein, but then going out with him, having consensual sex with him. You suggest you understand all of that because of what you went through. So what do you see as parallels? Because this happened when you were young, you were a journalist just starting out.
Yeah, well, I see the parallels because I remember in the morning after I was raped, I was thinking, okay, like maybe I should just go ahead and kill myself. The brain obviously wants to survive. And in order to survive, my brain decided to create this fiction where we were just doomed lovers. Like he was in love with me. I was in love with him. It was like a beautiful love story. But then throughout all my old emails, I keep dropping hints like it was confusing. There were some bad things that happened. And then I was also scared, but we're still in love. You know what I mean? Like I had such severe shock that I couldn't classify it as rape for a very long time. So Asia Argento describes how Harvey Weinstein, how he made her feel, you know, loved, and he was a friend and he cared for her. And the thing is that after you are raped, you can end up with these feelings like, I will never be loved. I am not worthy of having friends. I am not worthy of anyone caring for me, because like it's such a huge violation. It can override your entire view of yourself. And then to have that man, to have somebody who violated you in that way, turn around and say, but honey, you're actually loved. You're not worthless. I care about you. You know, it's all going to be okay. I think that she wanted to cling onto that psychologically. Mm-hmm. And I definitely wanted to cling onto that as well. And this is aside from the professional considerations, of course, where you have someone in your field more powerful and experienced than you are. He's already destroyed you physically and mentally. But, you know, I mean, I'm going to say something ugly here, but it's like it kicks in the back of your head. Like, he destroyed me, but maybe he'll make up for it somehow. Like, maybe it can still all be okay. You know what I mean? And yeah. women do make these calculations. And I think we should be talking about this. It's an uncomfortable subject, but we should be talking about it, because I think this happens to a lot more women than we realize.
Well, I mean, this is what we've been hearing all this week as a lot of actors come forward. And are you sensing that outside the U.S. people are opening up this conversation now because of the Weinstein revelations?
I have been really saddened to see a lot of my Russian friends in the film industry in Russia trying to deal with these revelations by playing them down, or by saying, but he's so talented, or by pointing out, well, you know, like women are gold diggers, you know, they'll seduce him and then they'll say whatever. You know, it's just, it's also on one hand, like I want to criticize them. But on the other hand, I went through this entire process in private with my own rapist. So I understand some of the feelings. I think that it's just too scary to think about the reality that we live in. And I think it's easier to try to justify what happened in some way.
To go back to your essay in Vox about your own experience, you don't name your attacker. Why is that?
I'm still afraid of him. That's one part of it. You know, he remains more powerful and more famous, and he could totally destroy me. That's A. And B, I also think that it would be my word against his. It's been years. You know, like after it happened, I had bruises and scratches on me. And technically, I suppose if I had been in any state to report this, the police would have probably had to take me seriously considering the state of my body. But that was years ago. You know what I mean? And where I'm at today, I think that naming him would actually do me more harm than good. And I'm just not even mentally or physically ready for the challenge. It pains me to admit this. And I wish I was a Wonder Woman about this. You know, we're all about empowerment today and how girls should be heroes. But in this particular situation, I am not ready to be the hero, I guess.
I mean, it sounds like the Weinstein episodes that's still kind of unraveling has empowered a lot of women to come out and speak out. I mean, you're included. But will the Weinstein scandal change anything? I mean, will countries like Russia be immune from any change that might come from the outside?
I think in Russia, a lot of structural change needs to happen before we can even begin to talk about dismantling the rape culture there. And I also think a lot of structural change needs to happen in the States with regards to rape culture, you know, because we have a system in place that protects wealthy, powerful men from their accusers. I don't know how long it will take to change any of this. I do think that we should not just be focusing on the horror of it, the very visceral horror of it. We should also be talking about the reality of what we're dealing with and how to make it better, how to practically make it better.
Writer, journalist, and playwright Natalia Antonova, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I've seen the results up close, and they're horrifying. One victim I spoke with summed it up best. When it first happened, she said she'd prefer death over the pain and the disfigurement. I'm talking about acid attacks committed by men as a form of revenge intended to humiliate women and force them to hide. This week, though, at an event in London, it was the opposite. The charity Aid Action organized a fashion show where all the models were acid attack victims from Bangladesh. My BBC colleague Tulip Mazumdar was there.
It was unexpectedly really emotional, actually. I'd spent the day with some of these women and girls, and I'd heard their stories and what they'd been through, and really understanding what it took for them to get on that stage. And it started off sort of a little bit morose. I think they were all quite nervous. They walked to the front. They sort of stared defiantly into the crowd. But then as the fashion show went on, some of them started dancing. They were smiling. And it showed that these women are not just victims, that they are survivors.
I mean, you can imagine that this may be, for some of these women, their most public presentation since their attacks. You spoke with one survivor of an attack, a woman named Nahar. Tell us about her.
She is a young woman. She's sort of in her late 30s now, but she was 15 years old when she was attacked.
The boy proposed me for love. Then I reject him, and he was angry. And one night, he came to my house and trashed it. It was very painful. I felt burning in my face, in my hand. I was screaming.
What did you think would happen to you, to your life at that point?
I thought it is finished. No chance to go back study or job or do something. I always try to hide myself. I wear cover in my face.
And what she went on to say later in our chat that you heard a little bit of there is, I can't change my face, but I can change my life. And that's what I'm doing. She's gone on. She's in the middle of doing a master's. She is actually the one that has created this survivors group where she is in touch with around 200 other acid attack survivors. Clearly, you know, this isn't a type of attack that you can play down in any way. These are horrific injuries. It has a lasting physical effect, obviously, but also a psychological effect. Many of these women are blamed for these attacks. They're ostracized from their communities because in many of these communities, a woman's worth is seen in her beauty and her capacity to marry. Once that is taken away by these men, certainly that's what they try to do, they are seen as a waste. And there are many more like them that are sitting at home, that are hiding, and that aren't getting the help they need. And that is who they are trying to reach out to.
You know, when we cover suicide in the media, we're careful to avoid the risk of inspiring copycat events. We avoid giving explicit details of the method used. Should we follow similar caution when we cover acid attacks?
Certainly internationally, this is violence against women. This is keeping women down. This is showing control, patriarchy. And actually, the way you stop these sorts of attacks, many of the charities who work with these women say, is that you deal with the innate extreme sexism that exists in some of these communities. And you teach and encourage communities to see women as equals, as people in their own right, and not as something that can be disrespected, injured in this way.
Finally, Tulip, this was a fashion show. What were the clothes like? Who were they wearing?
The clothes were absolutely glorious. They were bright colours. They were designed by a Bangladeshi designer. She's quite well known, and model called Bibi Russell. And they're kind of traditional Bangladeshi with a bit of a twist. So we had some saris in there. We had some shalwar kameez. It looked fantastic.
Good music.
The music was great, actually. Yeah. In fact, you know what? The girls at the end, they went into the crowd and they pulled people out of the crowd. And everybody at the end was just dancing on the stage with these girls.
My BBC colleague, Tulip Mazumdar, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, stamp collectors, if you're into controversial stamps, here's one you might want to get your hands on. It's a 1 euro stamp from the Republic of Ireland. 1 euro is about $1.20. It's the face on it that's causing controversy. Che Guevara, the famous, some would say infamous, Latin American revolutionary. Che, as you may recall, helped lead the communist revolution in Cuba in the 1950s, but was then caught and executed for trying to launch a revolution in Bolivia. So why a commemorative in Ireland? To answer that, the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, joins me in the studio. So this is that iconic image of Che, Chris, in his beret, the image that's adorned so many dorm rooms and T-shirts. Why is he on an Irish postage stamp?
Well, it's twofold, Marco. Partly, it's because he's of Irish descent.
Really?
Yeah, and also it's according to the Irish Postal Service, he's the quintessential left-wing revolutionary and is therefore being honoured. Yeah, Che's dad, Ernesto Guevara Lynch, used to say, "The first thing to note is that in my son's veins flowed the blood of Irish rebels."
Ernesto Lynch. Wow, that's incredible. Does the connection go back? That's when it started?
Actually, no, it goes pretty far back. Patrick Lynch was born in the western Irish city of Galway in 1715. So we're going back quite a way into a family that had lost its lands and property during the Wars of Religion in Ireland. So young Patrick did what so many ambitious young Catholic gentlemen did in that time, which was go to Europe to try and find new opportunities to make a living. And so he went first to the northern Spanish city of Bilbao and then followed that city's trade connections to the colony of Rio de la Plata, or as we now call it, Argentina. And the rest, as they say, is history. So it's a pretty upper-class family, played notable minor roles in the country's history and in the history of Chile as well. And that's on Che Guevara's father's side.
Incredible. This is why we have you come in the studio, Chris. So the image, I understand, was produced by an Irish artist as well, the image for the stamp. Did that help get Che on the stamp?
Well, the original photo is by a Cuban, Alberto Corda, who's now deceased. It took that in 1960. And then it was adapted to that famous two-tone image by the Irish artist Jim Fitzpatrick, who incidentally also did album covers for Thin Lizzy and Sinead O'Connor.
Oh, no kidding.
He's still alive, actually, and says he's honored by the decision of the Postal Service to use his image, which he's never patented, so he's not getting any money for it. But no, that was not part of the reasoning of the Irish Postal Service. That was the whole rebel thing.
Yeah, they say he's a rebel. But what is the controversy then? I mean, he's a son of Ireland. The Irish Postal Service says he's a rebel. What's the big deal?
Well, Ireland has this love-hate relationship with its left-wing revolutionary heritage, most recently embodied by the IRA. One Irish admirer has said that Che symbolizes the better nature of man. He was pursuing moral causes rather than material advantage. On the other hand, Ireland's also a very conservative country, and the violence that surrounds Che appalls many there. In fact, one conservative Irish senator, Neil Richmond, said, and I quote, he was a barbaric interrogator, a jailer and executioner of hundreds of supposed class enemies, and it is my belief that he is most definitely not a suitable candidate for such an honour. And of course, it's also caused controversy on this side of the pond as well, with Cuban Americans in Miami starting, of course, a letter writing campaign to the Irish Postal Service to complain about their choice of icon.
By the way, Chris, $1.20 for a stamp, that's not for your average letter, is it?
No, that's just for, you know, if you want to put $1.20 on a parcel or something like that. But it's mostly going to collectors, and there's been a huge demand for it. The stamp's first production run of over 120,000 has already sold out.
Wow. Well, despite how people feel about Che, he's on a stamp now. The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
We now know that Russian meddling in last year's U.S. election wasn't limited to hacking emails and trying to disrupt the actual voting process in 21 states. That alone would be alarming, of course, but the meddling extended far beyond that. As we've been finding out, Russian hackers also set out to influence American public opinion by spreading fake information via Facebook, Twitter, and Google. That included masquerading as supposedly pro-Trump Muslim Americans on social media. And here at The World, we happen to know someone who experienced this particular scheme first person. He's a comedian whose image was used by hackers. Dean Obadalla describes himself as a lawyer who tells jokes and the only Muslim American to host a daily national radio show. Great credentials, Dean.
Very much. I'm very proud of all of them.
And just to be clear for our listeners, Casey Kasem was of Druze extraction and his show was a weekly, not a daily. So you're good to go.
He was. He was certainly a pioneer in radio of any background in America and certainly a household name. And I actually look like him a little bit, as I've been told.
Well, thanks for being with us, Dean. We hear every day more about how Russian government hackers have infiltrated our social media accounts. Before you tell us what happened to you, just give us a big picture of Russian efforts to get in front of the eyes of Muslim Americans. What was their strategy?
Well, what we learned, and this was only recent, in fact, that they'd used a dormant Facebook account of a real Muslim American organization. And through their own research, had found out this organization was real, had a real website with real pictures of Muslim Americans. So they created a Facebook page for them and then started using that to get their message out.
How on earth did an image of you become part of this effort?
They also set up an Instagram account, these Russian hackers. And from the research of the Daily Beast, where I wrote my article for, the Russian government was involved with these hackers. It's our understanding. They also set up an Instagram account called Muslim Voices, was the actual name, to reach Muslims. And what they did is they shared real pictures of Muslims who are somewhat known in the Muslim American community that were real images, that they didn't fabricate these. And the one they used of me was from another organization where I was talking about, it's not Islam versus the West, it's all of us versus ISIS. So what they did was share that real image and many real images of other Muslim Americans to get credibility in the Muslim community. And by the end there, their Instagram account had somewhere over 70,000 followers who thought they were a real Muslim American organization.
How did you discover it was your picture?
Well, what happened was my editor at the Daily Beast said, hey, we have this scoop that the Russians pose as a Muslim organization on Facebook. Would you want to write about that? I said, sure. So I'm starting to write my article. And the other team of investigative writers, I'm an opinion writer, were back at the Daily Beast going through things. And one of them found the images they put up and then saw my picture and go, hey, by the way, you might want to add this to your article. You were part of the propaganda. I'm like, what? So it took on a whole new level of interest, because up until then, the Russian propaganda and trying to influence our election was more this kind of ambiguous thing that you read about in the news. All of a sudden became very personal. I mean, it was me. I mean, I was being used.
How long was this propaganda campaign, this Russian propaganda campaign, out of the gate before it took the real United Muslims of America to catch on how they were being used?
Apparently, and my understanding is correct, they didn't know they were being used until the Daily Beast broke the article a couple of weeks ago.
Wow. There was a suspicious post on social media after the Orlando terrorist attack at the Pulse nightclub last year. Tell us about that post.
Sure. I mean, it's only suspicious when you take a step back and understand American politics and how anti-Muslim bigotry plays in America. Because on its face, what they had posted, these Russian hackers, was from a Muslim Facebook page, United Muslims. Hey, we stand with Hillary after this shooting, and we're going to have a rally in Washington, D.C. outside of the White House to support Hillary Clinton. There was no Muslim group was going to do that. That made no sense. What they were playing on was that Trump supporters, and they were trying to help Trump win. Trump supporters, or even undecided, would say, look at these Muslims. There's a terrorist attack committed by one Muslim, and they're in bed with Hillary Clinton, and they're going to have a rally outside of the White House for Hillary Clinton. And look, they're palling around. Hillary's palling around with Muslim terrorists. That's sort of the idea. So again, that was a sophisticated way. It was, if a Muslim group had posted very pro-Trump things, it would have gotten no credibility. In fact, we would have all found out about it, because in the Muslim community, we're very active on Facebook and Twitter. We would have been sharing this, going, who are these guys posting pro-Muslim stuff? Because overwhelmingly, the Muslim American community rejected Donald Trump. And so they never did that. They were subtle, and they did sort of reverse psychology in their ads, again, playing on anti-Muslim bigotry.
So what has this done to the faith of Muslim Americans and how they trust certain groups online?
Muslims and Arab Americans, we're conspiratorial by nature as it is, so we're probably untrusting and very cynical about things. And also, to be honest, in another time, we probably could have focused on it more, but in Trump's America, where he still would like to ban Muslims in this country, and he gins up fear of various communities, that is so much more important, because the stakes are very real. And it's not just for the Muslim community, it's for Latino community, the African-American community, the LGBT community. In times of no trouble or strife, we could have all focused on this more and laughed. But, you know, an hour later, you'll have Trump tweeting about, I want to ban transgender Americans from serving the military, or I want an expanded new Muslim ban 3.0, which we have now. That's in the courts again. So it goes on and on with very real life things. It's unlike any time I've ever been in. I was born and raised in America. I follow politics all my life. I've never seen this. I've never felt more personally at risk. And our communities never felt more personally in peril than now with Trump as president.
I'm curious, too, whether this photo of you that was used by Russian hackers, has it caused you any trouble personally?
No, it's a pretty good photo. It's real. But it's more than haphazard. There's a strategy there in what they were doing. As opposed to, I've dealt with neo-Nazis in the last few months online who fabricated tweets of mine claiming I was taking responsibility for the Manchester bombing and I was involved with it. And I'm actually suing them in federal court.
Dean, what is it about you? You're irresistible to the extreme fringe.
I am stuck between Russia and the Nazis. I'm like Poland in World War II. I mean, I'm in a tough, it's a tough position where I'm sitting right now. I'm living like in a Tom Clancy novel.
Dean Obadala, the host of the Dean Obadala Show on Sirius XM. He calls it the only daily national radio show hosted by a Muslim American. Thanks very much, Dean. Good to speak.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
More sounds from Johnny Clegg and Jaluka from South Africa that take us out today. Clegg starts a farewell tour on Saturday here in Boston. He's calling it The Final Journey. And on Sunday morning at 11 Eastern Time, Johnny Clegg and I will sit down before a live audience to talk about his life and his music and how he managed to skirt the laws of South Africa's apartheid regime and lead a multiracial band. If you're not in Boston, don't worry. Hear the whole conversation on Facebook Live on Sunday, again at 11 a.m. Eastern, so check the local time difference. Marco Werman here at the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Enjoy the weekend, everyone.
PRI, Public Radio International.